3, 2, 1.
Welcome to episode 150 of the Preble Hall podcast.
Well, it's great to have everybody here. I know Abby Mullen is going to be joining us at the halftime show here. But today we've got a pretty full house. We've got Dr. Marcus Jones from the History Department. Marcus, welcome. Always good to see you.
Glad to be here.
And Dr. Tyler Petroff, now with Naval History and Heritage Command.
Pleasure to be back.
And our latest and greatest PhD doctor, Stephen Phillips.
Also great to be here. Thanks, Claude.
It's good to have the team. You know, when I first started Preble Hall almost 3 years ago, 150 episodes ago, the game plan was to have co-hosts because I think, you know, I didn't want to listen to my own voice for all these episodes. So first of all, thanks to all of you and Abby, who will be joining us later on, for taking the time to interview. And I'm going to start with this question to you all. This is a free-for-all episode, by the way, for our listeners. And it's basically just to celebrate 150 episodes, which I didn't think we would get to. We have. I hope we have 150 or more as a Naval History Pod. But let's go around the table. What do you see, I'll start with you, Tyler, as the value for having Naval History Podcasts?
Can I ask you a question first before we do that? What did you think the podcast series was going to be when you started it? How long did you think it was going to run?
I thought I'd be doing it for maybe a year, and I wasn't sure because I was the only one doing it. We bought some mics and some cheap equipment. The reason I thought of Preble Hall was because I was deployed to Gitmo and Guantanamo Bay, and in the morning I'd walk or run for about 45 minutes, and I'd listen to a podcast, and then at night I'd swim, so I obviously couldn't listen to a podcast, but listen to a variety of things. But I'm a naval historian. I wanted to listen to naval history, and I couldn't find one that was devoted to that.
What was out there at the time that dealt with naval affairs or even obliquely with naval history?
Well, I mean, Commander Salamander and Eagle One have midrats, and once in a while they'll have somebody from history, and there's a couple of others here and there. But strictly devoted to history, naval history, I really couldn't find it. So I thought, look, this is a great project for Preble Hall Naval Academy Museum. We're at the heart of it. We're the oldest Navy museum in the country. Why not us? So I think that's really what I started to think about was when you guys first started doing this, when I asked you, what did you think we would do?
Well, I mean, personally, I see this as almost equal parts oral history and entertainment. And when I say entertainment, I don't mean, you know, cheap laughs at someone's expense, but specifically, what I'm getting at is it's a kind of oral history which is a lot looser and a lot more free-flowing than any other kind of history is. And as a result of that, you tend to get, and I'm sure everyone here can think of 10, 15, 20 examples of this, stories that you might not get otherwise in more traditional oral history. The easiest example that pops into my mind is Peter Swartz ending up in the Vietnamese mob's fake restaurant in St. Petersburg. So with that sort of thing, though, what makes memories stick into your head better? Stories stick into your head better.
And it's the community pig outreach program.
Yeah, exactly, right? The interesting tidbits are what pop up in your mind at random times, and then it pulls along all that other information that you might not have otherwise retained. And why I think that's so valuable is because what else is this if not a teaching aid of some kind?
Yeah.
And sure, it's great for recommending to midshipmen. It's great for recommending to just history students at any college or even high school. But at the same time, at my new job at the Naval History and Heritage Command, it's great to be able to point to podcast episodes and say, oh, if you need a quick overview of this, go listen to the Peter Swartz interviews from Preble Hall. I have to admit, since I went over there in May, I have told at least 15 different people to do that, and they've all done it sung its praises.
Well, that's a great point about the oral histories because, you know, I'm a big fan of Brian Lamb and when he used to do the interviews on C-SPAN, and it was very basic questions that anybody could ask, and so I've always tried to have that approach. Take it to the basic level and let people talk.
That's the model.
But in terms of oral histories, you know, that's one thing we tried to do, especially during the height of COVID. We had about 5 interviews, including with Vice Admiral Buck, the superintendent, and about their experiences as it was happening, because we didn't have that from 1919 and the Spanish influenza here at the Academy. So now what I did is I had them transcribed, and I had those put over at Special Collections and Archives. So, you know, if something like this occurs in the future, future soups, professors know what we went through and, you know, suggestions. Steve?
Another comment about the format, and Tyler was alluding to this, and this is one of the things that I like about podcasts. And we even talked about this mechanically when we talked about scheduling episodes, because we had set goals of like, hey, let's make sure that an episode is posted on Sunday night. And there have been times when I've reflected back to the team and said, okay, want to get it done by Sunday night, but once it's up, it's there forever. Mm-hmm. And I have gone on our dashboard to see how many folks download each of the various episodes and when they do. I think we have a core group of folks that it's an automatic feed. Like mm-hmm. they automatically get the newest episode. But there's definitely other folks that are coming in later. They hear about the podcast from somebody. Tyler tells one of his students. I have related to folks. And I've had people reach out to me and say, Steve, I heard this podcast, and it may not even be one of my episodes. You know, send me the link again so that I can go back and listen to it. It's there forever now, as long as Preble Hall chooses to have it up online. Right. And so what I like about the podcast is it's building. You know, when it started, Claude, am I right that sort of the first approach was your 100 objects? Was that part of the podcast, or was that done separately?
No, the 100 objects was separate, and I think I was thinking of maybe using some of those for this, but this was, it was just far more robust in terms of a conversation. And when I started it, it wasn't just going to be about Naval Academy history. I think we've maybe done 10 or 12 episodes about Naval Academy history, including the great one you did on the Great Mule Caper of 1991, which I think is still one of the top listened to episodes.
Two. The number one episode, and this is how it goes. I've bragged about this. The number one episode is the first episode on Nelson's Gunners, and why? Yeah. When somebody encounters a podcast, they listen to the first episode.
True. Also, Kate Jamieson from England is...
She has a large following.
She has a huge following, and she's awesome.
But the number two one is the Great Mule Caper... talking about my class stealing all four mules in that for the 1991 football game. And what's interesting is it's Naval Academy history. It's also humor and entertainment, as Tyler said.
Yeah, it's also FBI criminal history. I was really worried with that episode.
Statute of limitation expired,
yeah.
Fortunately.
Yeah, I was really worried about that episode. I was like, you know, who's going to get arrested after this one? But I mean, I wanted to have it as an international flavor, all time periods, and we've had that. We've had ancient. I mean, one of my favorite people to interview is Dr. Jorrit Vintjes from, is it University of Würzburg?
Würzburg, yeah.
Yeah. And I think we did four episodes with him, you know, something on the Gallic Wars, something on Tiberius's amphibious assaults into Germany in 4 AD. So it had to have that kind of flavor in terms of content. And then the people I wanted to interview were not just historians. It was historians, practitioners like General Mike Williams, who was a graduate in 1968, and he headed up Operation Sea Signal in 1994, 1995 off of Guantanamo Bay in Haiti. There are midshipmen. I think we've interviewed about a half a dozen midshipmen. Graduate students. I've said this many times, I love interviewing graduate students because they're still right in the heart of that material. And going back to what you were talking about, Tyler, is that there's, you know, so we tend to forget, you know, Marcus and I, a little older, we've probably forgotten some of the things we've written at this point, but they're still deeply involved in that material, and they can go into depth in a way that other historians can't.
It's a great way to bring them into the community of practice as well.
Yeah.
You know, make their work and their names more accessible and familiar to historians.
And it makes them more comfortable in this, you know, just speaking and talking about an issue. I know they go to conferences, so.
One of the things that I like doing on those that are oral histories, which are with people that are not necessarily historians, are folks that connect us to naval history and to the museum itself. So again, when I interviewed Tony Nehichevansky, he was the EOD technician that rendered safe the Exocet missile on board USS Stark in May of 1987. Well, the warhead is here in the museum. And so in interviewing him, first, we get a broad brush of an interesting naval operation. Second, you get a sailor's view of something that happened at the deck plate. And then it's actually connecting you to something that's here in the museum itself.
Who was your favorite person to interview or your favorite episode?
I mean, that's actually kind of easy for me, and it's because I'm a little bit of ashamed, a little bit ashamed with the way that went, and that would be the Peter Schwartz interview that I sat in on more than participated in. Because while there were times that I chimed up during that, I felt like a sound engineer sometimes because I was just so enthralled by the story he was telling that Marcus would ask a basic question like we talked about, and Peter would just run with it. And that would be it, right? He would talk for the next 30 minutes, 40 minutes mm-hmm. sometimes. You would not have to prompt him at all with anything to take from there. And I would forget myself and forget what I was there for just because I was so interested in listening to what he was saying.
I haven't done very many interviews, honestly. Of those I've done, I have a hard time distinguishing among the one or couple that I like the most. Honestly, I think the one I enjoyed doing the most, for very parochial reasons, was the one I did with you, Tyler, about your dissertation.
And I was sweating bullets during that one because I was still effectively a graduate student.
Such
at that
a
point.
Fascinating topic. It was really fascinating to hear somebody who knew it inside and out.
Remind the listeners what that episode was about. That was a two-parter.
Let me preface this too before I point anybody to the actual episode by saying, you know, that the project has been refined rather considerably since then. So I know a lot more about the people and the ins and outs rather than just the technical end of things that I was more familiar with at that time. But Marcus is referencing the U.S. Navy's adoption of high-temperature, high-pressure steam propulsion in the interwar period, which sounds like a bit of an inane, highly technical subject, and admittedly, it is an extremely technical subject. But it's something that involved every major name in the Navy that you would recognize from World War II in that time period, and had some really, really significant ramifications to the U.S. war effort, in addition to the way that the U.S. Conceptualized ship design and the way the U.S. procured warships. The net result of that was the merger of the Bureau of Engineering and the Bureau of Construction and Repair into Bew Ships in 1940. And, of course, then the U.S. had to fight a world war with the end product of that, which was the high steam system, which equipped pretty much every major warship in the U.S. inventory.
What made it a great podcast was your ability to talk about the technical specificity of it. And that for me, it was engrossing. It was the easiest, which is the entire reason why I do these. They're the thinnest possible pretext to have a fascinating conversation with somebody, which is all that I'm looking.
The only thing missing is that
to
we
find
have
every day anyway.
Yeah, the only thing missing is martinis and scotch, which would
exactly.
make it even better.
It's worth mentioning, I didn't even get into, really, the people beyond Harold Bowen and the very basics with that. I didn't get a chance to talk about Thomas Hart's involvement with that. Yeah. I didn't get a chance to talk about who else was on the board. And I mean, we're talking Admiral Horn, who ends up as VCNO. We're talking members of the triumvirate that are controlling the U.S. nuclear weapons at the end of the war. These are really, really important people. But hey, I also really like talking about technical specifications, which is why I was able to get into that.
Steve?
I have many favorite episodes and many people that I enjoyed interviewing. I think one of mine that I'd like to mention was early on, episode 15, when you interviewed Ken Sable. I think it was called Wings Over the Severn. Mm-hmm. I found it fascinating because it talked about a period of Naval Academy history and about local history, of which I had no idea. And he talked about how aviation was introduced here at the Naval Academy, why the Naval Academy is one of the places that can claim to be a birthplace of naval aviation. And then he got into Greenbury Point and how it had been a seaplane base, and then even into how that whole region over there, Cape St. Clair, et cetera, before the Bay Bridge was built, that was intended to be the original Pensacola. There was a plan that there was going to be this large naval aviation training base there.
I forgot about that. That's a great insight.
I found it fascinating. And so again, for me, as a naval historian, as a grad, as somebody who grew up here locally, that episode just hit all the right wickets with me. It was just fascinating. And that's one I go back and listen to again and again.
And can I interject? I apologize.
Yeah, no.
Going all the way back to the first thing we talked about, why do naval history podcasts and how is it different than normal oral history? Where are you going to get little local stories like this, little tidbits of history that you aren't otherwise going to be aware of? Because oral history isn't usually going to zero in on very small things like that. And that's small, of course, meaning, you know, the amount of space it occupies, not necessarily small as in an insignificant part of history.
And that goes back to the oral histories because one of my favorite people to interview was Paula Clark, and she's been with the Barbershop here at the Naval Academy for more than 35 years. And to, you know, one thing that's sometimes lacking in looking at history of the Naval Academy, we look at the faculty, we look at the midshipmen, what they did after they graduated. Nobody ever looks at the staff and the people who make this place run on a day-to-day basis. So I got to interview her, interviewed somebody who had been with laundry here for almost 50 years, and got his, you know, perspective on living in Annapolis. Tal Manville, retired captain, and this was, I think it was the anniversary of Anderson v. Laird, which basically said that you didn't have to have mandatory chapel for midshipmen anymore. And he was one of the midshipmen who fought it, who fought mandatory services. And so to get his perspective, nobody else was interviewing him about this. So we're able to reach out in a way through the podcast to the people who have been doing these things, have lived. And that's why I tell my midshipmen, you've got to interview some of the older graduates, because we don't want to lose those stories.
So 500 podcasts over this period of time, correct?
150.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know where I got the number.
Your daughter opened the show with 150, Marcus.
That's fine. I think I was looking at something earlier today for which the number was 500. Regardless, it's a lot of podcasts. Are you able to talk about the ones that didn't go as well or as expected?
You know, I think the ones that didn't go as expected are where you don't get as much detail and flavor and color commentary as you might hope. There were very few of those, but there were a couple that I think it could have been enriched, and it was simply a matter of, I think, experience. And we're joined finally by Dr. Abby Mullen, the other co-host here. Come on in, Abby. But I think one of my favorite episodes was a two-parter we did, a special one with CIMSEX, the Center for International Maritime Security. And this evolved from a discussion on Twitter about G.I. Joe. And I pointed out, well, no, there was an old G.I. Joe episode in the 1980s that featured the USS Constitution saving the day because it wasn't going to suffer from an EMP. And so we did an episode discussing, you know, all these issues about that and the USS Montana, a battleship. Well, I reached out. I found the writer, the guy who wrote that episode, David Caron, and I did an episode with him. And it turns out he actually did research on the Constitution, and he did research on what was proposed to be the USS Montana, and that's why they drew it in such a way in the episode. So to see that naval history could play a role in G.I. Joe.
What was his reaction when you contacted him?
He was shocked, but this is a guy who had been in, he had done a lot of TV over his career. He was an instructor now, professor. And I mean, I think he had written for, like, not Dukes of Hazzard, but there were a lot of 70s and 80s shows that, but he just had a great time and wonderful to deal with him. And so, Abby, welcome.
Thank you.
And welcome to teaching at the U.S. Naval Academy.
Thank
so we have
you.
A lot of firsts.
Yeah.
And you, in addition to being a co-host, you were also the second or third guest?
I think third, yeah. I think I'm episode three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were talking to Abby, and I know our schedules were misaligning for today, but it's all right.
Meetings, I tell you.
What were some of the episodes that stood out in your mind that either that you enjoyed, really got something out of the discussion with the guest, or any other reason?
So I already told the person who was the featured guest about this, but I really liked all of the interviews that you all did with Peter Swartz. Maybe you've already talked about this. He's such a lovely person, for starters. And then he is part of an era of naval history that I know horrifyingly little about. And he's so eloquent in explaining what was going on that, for me, who has loudly said in the past that I don't care about anything in the 20th century, it was great. I know. I'm sorry. I'm learning, though. I'm learning there's value in the 20th century.
Yeah, relief for him to hear.
Yes. But he's been very gracious to me just personally. So it was really interesting to hear his story. So that's like the first one that comes to mind, honestly, is the, what were there, three or four episodes with him? They were great.
Now, Abby, you also brought in a different perspective because you had had a podcast for, well, I think probably a year getting into this one. What are the things that you learned from your podcast, which, I, by the way, I listened to every episode of Consolation Prize, because they dealt with the consoles that nobody ever dealt with. Again, have a podcast and you can focus on anything. What do you think are some of the lessons that you learned from Consolation Prize that we should adopt for, say, the next 150 episodes?
Besides
better production value, well, besides me producing these things.
That's something that's easy to deal with. I think one of the things that I've tried to bring into my episodes on Preble Hall that I learned with doing Consolation Prize is just making sure that your interview has a narrative. There's an arc even to the interview, because it's a different way of doing podcasting. On Consolation Prize, we would interview people, but then we'd like pull out pieces of it and tell the story ourselves. So Preble Hall is like a little bit of a different kind of podcast, but I do think there's still value in it being a narrative and having a sense when you're asking questions of, like, where are we going with this, or what's the bigger question we're trying to answer? And I think that helps the guests too, because then they have a better sense of what you might actually want to ask them, and then they're not blindsided by stuff. I'm not saying that any of you have been doing a bad job with that, by the way.
What topic would you guys like to address in the future for an interview, or who would you most like to interview?
John Hattendorf? I'm going to reach out.
Why?
He's like Mr. Naval History. I mean, he's got a whole Naval History Center named after him. So
up at War College.
Yeah.
Marcus?
I'm enamored of the practice of identifying and bringing in for really intensive conversations that second, third tier of leadership and, you know, assistant secretaries of the Navy, deputy assistant secretaries, ENCODE heads, retired flag officers who ran programs, things like that that provide terrific perspectives into the sinews of how things in the course of their careers, which were at this point the 80s and 90s and 2000-aughts, how they were understood and how things got done and in response to what kinds of constraints and priorities. In other words, you know, kind of the structuring stuff of good naval history inquiry. I suppose that amounts to a kind of oral historical process, but maybe a little bit more deconstructed a process, and one that allows them freer range to talk outside the lines occasionally or reflect a little bit more speculatively about things. Those for me are the most enjoyable to do, in part because the process of doing them involves listening to these people themselves oftentimes work through their impressions and recollections and things to which
in a way they wouldn't normally be approached, because people are tend to approach, say, if you're a former Secretary of Defense or former Secretary of the Navy, they don't go down to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy level, for example, or the program managers, the civilians who have been around there, the Pentagon, for, you know, 30, 40 years.
It sounds maybe pedestrian or not terribly interesting, but you realize pretty quickly that everybody has a story. And a lot of those stories are not just salient, they're also really interesting. And they can be made more so by good questioning that draws people out. I'm also just enamored of the ability of people in good organizations, otherwise normal people, to accomplish really remarkably complicated things. That's kind of the story of organizational history generally.
I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but Steve and Tyler?
I want to interview more authors who've written historical pieces. I've done three or four so far. One of my favorite episodes that I was not the host for was Brian Vandermark. He was interviewed for his book, Road to Disaster, A New History of America's Descent into Vietnam. He had been one of my professors. I had read his book, Into the Quagmire, as part of his course. Hearing that, it was a very nice bookend to his look at Vietnam. So I find those fascinating because you read the book as the interviewer, and then you get to hear even more from the author through the interviewing process. So I'm hoping to do more of those.
Tyler?
A bit of a two-parter for this answer, and part one of that is I have to double down on exactly what Marcus said, and the reason why is because this has been an intense learning process for me on late 20th century naval history. I am an interwar historian. I, before we started this and I got involved, was really not very knowledgeable on anything after 1960. And that has changed very quickly and very radically, in large part because of what we've done as part of this podcast. Of course, that's ended up being quite useful for me now, where I find myself in my career being presented with immediate Navy problems. So I'm very grateful for that as well. And I've become much more acutely aware of the complete lack of historical knowledge we have on really anything after 1995. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to find a starting point for that, this is it. For, again, exactly the reasons that Marcus enunciated. This is a deconstructed way of approaching it, and you're going to get at the roots of issues that you may not find any other way to get at this way.
I'll just second what Tyler said. I also now have a much better appreciation for more contemporary Navy history because of the podcast, so I've changed my mind about 20th century history and 21st century.
But going back to Tyler and Marcus, in your case, Marcus, organizational development and what value they can bring, is there a value to learning from the episodes for today's environment? I mean, we do this, and some of the episodes are entertaining. You know, I did one on Academy graffiti, but then we discussed how it might be incorporated into an anthropology class, which the midshipmen did here. So there was some value to it. But in terms of understanding some of these, Marcus, the program managers or the assistant secretaries of the Navy or Defense, is there a value to understanding how they did things and relating it to what we are doing today?
If there isn't, I'm not sure why we have a history department at the Naval Academy.
That's a good point.
I still have part two from my previous response as well. I did part one. So the previous thing I said, I have a two-parter, and part two that I would like to what I would like to do in the future is I want to know who the heck some of these naval historians are. For example, my own mentor, John Smita, has a fairly colorful personal history. And if there would be a way to convince him to discuss it a little bit, it would go a long way to preserving not just his own history, but why he has approached history the way he has and why he's had the impact and started the arguments that he has in the historical community. And we don't have to talk about
that. Perhaps to unpack the way in his career the academic discipline of history has evolved and changed.
Yes.
That's an oblique way to get at.
I think that is very significant, and I know there's been a little bit of that on this podcast, but I think that would there would be a lot of value added to try and include a little bit more of that. Because again, who these people are is very significant to the way they have approached problems that they have.
John Hattendorf.
Yes, and that's what made me think of it, quite frankly, is when you suggested John Hattendorf, my brain started going about a million miles an hour about who else it would be extremely valuable to talk to for those reasons.
And obviously, Craig Simons. Who else? Absolutely. What other naval historians would you want to speak to?
It would be nice if we were better able to branch out and begin to engage the international naval historical community.
Yeah.
We've
yes.
done a little bit of that with Jorrit, but to be perfectly honest, he's low-hanging fruit because the guy...
he does a lot.
He not only speaks incredibly, you know, incredibly sophisticated English, but he works in so many fields and works in them very well. But there are international naval historians.
My own advisor, Professor Andrew Lambert, the Lawton Naval History Chair at King's College London. Bring him in here, Duren and McMullen, and sit down with him for an hour, and you know it'll be a fascinating discussion.
The problem we have is that we tend to be parochial to the English-speaking world by necessity, but there are thriving naval historical communities of inquiry across the globe. In Japan, the National Institute of Defense Studies, connected to the Defense Ministry, has a very active section of intensive naval historians who've studied everything from the development of modern Japanese naval types to the operational strategic history of the Second World War. The transformation of the post-war Japanese Navy into the self-defense forces, all of them representing trajectories of inquiry that would connect to, overlap with, diverge interestingly from U.S. naval history, but would be unfailingly interesting to hear about.
And something I've been looking at recently are the naval historians in the post-war era who were all Navy reservists. I started coming up, list a name after name who worked either in Office of Naval Intelligence or, you know, obviously the most famous one is Samuel Eliot Morison. There's a question. What historian from the past would you love to interview? And I'd say it's Morison, because one of my mentors in grad school was Ray Robinson, and actually his brother, coincidentally, was the only flag officer to die during Vietnam, Rembrandt Robinson. He died in a helicopter crash at sea. And he had studied under Morison, and I just remember the words that Ray would have about this man. But here's a guy who knew FDR, who wrote right from the front, but he wasn't the only one. And as I started pulling the string on this, how many there were.
Would you want to interview him with an eye toward drawing out his tendentious misinterpretations of things? I mean, seeing things now differently than he would have preferred. That's an easy one for me. It would be Edward Beach. Whose history of the Navy is my favorite, however long in the tooth people describe it as being. It's still, to me, the most readable history of the U.S. Navy. It's a beautiful book to read. It was one of the first I ever read and still love. Plus, he was a distinguished operator. And the ability to straddle that divide between the active naval forces and he had a terrific career, a multifaceted career, but also to transition into really serious reflection on the history and the trajectory of the institution is that's an exceptionally rare talent.
Also wrote one of the great war novels too.
Yes, made into a movie.
Yeah, I'd have to list E.B. Potter then as one of those naval historians, only because E.B. Potter taught here for so many years at the Naval Academy. His book was used as a textbook for history classes, but also he was communicating directly with Nimitz and all of the other flag officers to make sure that what he was writing in there were whether or not they were accurate, at least a reflection of how they saw things.
He was doing the work we should be doing with the flag officers still alive today.
Tyler.
I don't know if I can comment on that one.
Who would you guys like to interview of ages past? Somebody who's not available now.
I got to think on that one.
Honestly, the one that comes to mind for me for a really simple reason is Garrett Mattingly.
And wrote the Armada.
Yes, because...
That's why, Tyler, I was here producing, but listening to that interview, and... Oh, no, wait, that's one we did with Nick Lambert, wasn't it? And you mentioned Armada, and that's why I ended up...
That might have been with BJ, actually.
Oh, was it?
Commander Armstrong.
Okay, all right.
But it, definitely one of those. Yeah, that's precisely why, right? Because this is... his book on the Armada, which was written in the 50s, remains the book that I give everyone who comes up to me and says, "You're a historian. What's a history book I should read?" And I think I own 4 copies of that book now because they just keep getting lent out to everybody. And I don't think I have ever had anyone who has actually opened the book say to me, I didn't end up really grabbing me. It, universally, the story has always been.
Absolutely agree.
Absolutely fascinating.
I read it this summer. It was fantastic.
How did he do that? That's my question.
We're allowed to select historians of non-American.
Absolutely.
I'm going to amend my answer.
Leopold von Ranke?
It would be Nicholas Montserrat, whose novel, The Cruel Sea, is hands down the best book, in my opinion, on the U-boat campaigns in the North Atlantic during World War II. And admittedly, it's a work of fiction, but I would assign it as readily as I would any work of nonfiction in a history course. It's that good. Yeah. So I'll go with Nicholas Montserrat on top of Edward Beach. I'd like to have dinner with the two of them together.
I've got mine now.
Go for it.
So I'd like to go back to the War of 1812 and interview Theodore Roosevelt and talk about his writing. Well, he stole mine. Mine was Edward Beach, so he stole mine. So then I was like, all right, so I'd like to sit down with Teddy. Yeah.
Would you like to sit down with Teddy Roosevelt as a Harvard senior writing The War of 1812, or President Roosevelt having reflected on the War of 1812?
With the president. I'd like to sit down with the president.
You might not get a word in edgewise.
I think he would be fun to talk to as a senior in college. I think it would be interesting to hear him talk about what he thinks about the War of 1812, and then I have the chance to reflect on what that ended up meaning for him later. So I do have a plan B here. someone stole Teddy Roosevelt from me, which is I would like to interview Fletcher Pratt, who wrote Preble's Boys.
Oh, good choice.
Which, despite its lack of footnotes, which is endemic to its period, it's a great book. It's a really good read. And it's why I do the First Barbary War. So Fletcher Pratt, he's my man.
An avid war gamer, too.
Yeah.
I thank all of you for participating in the first 150 episodes and look forward to future productions. But I'd like listeners to hear about something that you've all worked on that you've really enjoyed in your careers, whether long or short. What is the, and it can be a dissertation, it can be a book, can it be an article?
It's also a tough question, to be fair. Oh, Marcus disagrees about it being a tough question?
Tell us, Marcus.
I think I have decades more time as a historian than the other three people here, however old they may be. I'm a little ashamed to reflect on it, to be honest, and not pull out something that I would hold up,
ages ago.
The damn thing I've ever produced. Yeah. All
right. What's the one piece that if you could tell listeners to read from your work, what would it be?
It would be my chapter on mine warfare during Operation Earnest Will from my dissertation, which, because I just completed it recently, I do hope becomes a book. It's a really important warfare area that few know enough about. I reflected on it a little bit in my interview with Paul Wren. You know, Iran had a $2,000 Russian design World War I mine, nearly sunk a ship and caused $93 million of damage. Mine warfare is the means in which a smaller power can attack a blue water navy.
Talking asymmetric.
Yeah. And so during my exam, that was the piece that I think had the most discussion. And it's because other aspects of Operation Earnest Will, I think, are more well known than the mine warfare piece. And so my hope is that that has some impact in the future.
Tyler?
Well, I don't know if everyone else was paying attention after the last exchange right before Steve chimed in. I had my head in my hands for a moment, and it's because I was remembering, Marcus, when I first met you, I went up to your office here, and you said, "You're Tyler Pitroff. I've just read your master's thesis." And I believe my reaction was something akin to, "Why?"
Where else does one have so clear, find so clear an exposition of reduction gearing?
Yes, and also in regards to, do you ever go back and read your own work? I tried to read my master's thesis a couple of different times while I was writing my dissertation, and I was not particularly happy with the way it came across, which is one of the largest understatements I think I've ever made in my entire life. But that being said, I definitely sympathize with what Marcus said, where, you know, you can get to the point where you think when you're writing that you're happy with the project, and then you go back and read it a year later and you say, "What is this garbage?"
Wasn't that Frederick Jackson Turner who every time he wanted to hand in his thesis on the frontier would pull it out of the mailbox before he, he did so because he said, "It's just not ready yet."
Yeah. And I feel like I've gotten a little bit better at being less of a perfectionist in that and more understanding that, of course, life is a learning process and you will always learn more about something after you've published it. And when we interviewed Claude, Nick Lambert, he said to me, I believe right after that interview, when I was telling him about the progress I was with my book, he said, "You're never going to be happy with it. You're going to be pleased with the way certain parts are, but you're going to have to draw the line somewhere and understand that there are parts that you won't that you'll come back to later and probably not be super happy with, no matter how you feel about them now." Getting to a point where something accurately encapsulates your thinking at a moment in time is something that you can be happy with, even if you go back to it later and say, my thinking at the time was flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, again, in this process of turning my dissertation material, which was that interview way back, like 39, episode 39 and 40 or something like that, or 40 and 41, my thinking has changed. It has the exploration of that information has expanded in a lot of ways. And I think the format of that, as it currently stands as a book manuscript, very accurately encapsulates where I've gotten. And I'm very proud of that, because where I've gotten with that project is explaining the cultural situation that the Navy found itself in at the time and how this influenced its approach to problems and how it both caused and solved other problems in as an extension of that. And I think that's very instructive to where we find ourselves now, where OpNav may ask questions along the lines of, well, how did the Navy decide what technologies it should invest in the interwar period? And the answer, of course, to that is, well, you know, some were good ideas and some were bad ideas. There was no secret sauce to figuring out exactly how that worked.
Mission portfolio.
So, exactly. So that book project, which apparently is going before an editorial board later this year, is, I think, very, very, very significant to where we find ourselves now. And so, yeah, my dissertation research still, I think, is, and of course many graduate students would say this at one point or another in their career, but I think my dissertation research is a valuable contribution to figuring out what we should be doing, or at least how we should be approaching problems now.
Abby.
Well, I'm very proud of Consolation Prize, if I'm being totally honest. I think the history of the U.S. Consular Service is grossly understudied, and they're super interesting, and you never run out of things to talk about with consuls. But also, I'm hopeful that in 2 years or so, or whenever it gets published, my book will actually be an important intervention into the early history of the Navy. There hasn't been a real scholarly monograph about just the First Barbary War since 1995, so it's time for a new one. And I think that makes some pretty good arguments, so I'm happy with it, unlike all of you. I'm also revising it right now, so I'm, you know, it's a day-to-day process, but I think that I have things to say about the early American Navy that are worth hearing.
Good. All right, just to wrap this up, thank you to each and every one of you, Dr. Tyler Petroff, Dr. Stephen Phillips, Dr. Abby Mullen, and Dr. Marcus Jones. Thanks for all the time that you all put in to this podcast to make it better, to make stories interesting, make stories available to people, to make stories available for the future. So, and to our listeners, thanks for 150 episodes sticking with us. We hope you enjoy 150 more. And if you have any suggestions, please reach out to us here at the Naval Academy Museum. If you've enjoyed listening to these podcasts, please leave feedback on any of the platforms you're listening to this. Have a great day.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.